This is tape number 13 of Goblin Hood Satyricon, copyright 1995 by James Biotti, read by Goblin Hood. This tape commences during a discussion of some love letters written by St. Cloud a long time previous to these events. Actually, that's not quite accurate. It's some love letters misplaced by St. Cloud. Thank you very much. So let's go on. Speaking off the cuff, this wasn't like the cognitive dissonance, if that's the right term, experienced by Goblin Hood whenever he was simultaneously believing conflicting things about his pet Martian Zoni, or, say it very softly, about his creator's mother's death. At least GH was aware of those dichotomies and could try to control his behavior in regards to any problems they created. No, this was something light years beyond that sort of inconvenience, and far scarier in all kinds of ways. One interesting question would be, how many things in St. Cloud's life was St. Cloud just not looking at, or at least not seeing? But a better question is this: who was Mr. Big, really, when St. Cloud was doing things behind his own back and then forgetting about them? Was it St. Cloud? His subconscious? None of the above? For some reason, it seemed very important to the gob that he somehow managed to figure out the answer to this. But it shouldn't for a moment be believed that the moon and the sun stopped, not even the ones associated with this alternate and other dimensional earth containing Sodom, while Goblin Hood was maundering about this crap. Instead, time passed. Hey, Earth to Goblin Hood. Come in, Goblin Hood. Huh? It was Mandragora leaning forward to snap her fingers in his face. You were really zoned out there for a moment, she explained. It was probably the Ichor zoning him out. I was? He asked. You were muttering something about Mr. Big, she offered. Not being able to read his mind was driving her bats. I was, he repeated. I think it had something to do with the Shogun squirrel, she elaborated. But perhaps the Ichor had zoned her out for a brief time as well. It did? He inquired doubtfully, eyeing the now snoring squirrel. Never mind, she sighed, deciding to change the subject. But a part of her mind still sort of wondered how the gob could find anything funny about Vlad the Impaler. And so she chose a topic which she thought might shed some light on this subject. What got you interested in collecting atrocity documentation? She asked him while the squirrel snored on. Actually, confided the gob, my creator got into it when he was less than 9 years old. The February 1960 issue of Reader's Digest condensed a book called Web of Conspiracy by Theodore Roscoe about the Lincoln assassination. The article included a photograph of the conspirators being hanged, and it had a profound effect on the young artist. He began building a toy gallows out of blocks. He'd make toy soldiers stand on a flat, square block supported by a short, round, thin Lincoln log block with a string attached to it. This was the floor of a gallows made of square alphabet blocks with steps in back and long rectangular blocks as beams and a string noose, of course. He'd read out the sentence or whatever and ask it if there were any last words. Then he'd pull the Lincoln log string and whammo! 6, she suggested. Oh, I don't know. A year or so later, the company that made plastic toy monster models put a working toy guillotine on the market, and the crazy bastard was sort of vindicated. Hell, he was state of the art. She laughed. What do you think of guillotining, by the way, as compared to hanging, for instance? G.H. shuddered. Pretty creepy, even given the context. They say all you feel is a short, sharp shock, and then you're literally dead before you even know it. The head lives on for a few seconds or so, they say, and, well, I don't know. What's so creepy about that? She wondered. It sounds pretty painless to me. Yeah, maybe, but it's just so weird. Like a whole unique form of existence, you know? There's being awake, there's being asleep, and then there's the few seconds or so when you're already quite dead, but you think you're still alive. It's the true shock of realization right at the end that seems horrible to me, the feeling, perhaps, that this isn't so bad, followed by the dawning awareness that this can't possibly last. It just seems cruel and unusual to me. But death isn't supposed to be fun, she objected. There must always be a second or two, one way or another. When you know you're gone, you know you can't come back, you know you have to let go. It's that helplessness that makes it seem so terrible. But then, in those seconds, as you accept that you're lost, you're at fate's mercy. That's when you learn the one great truth about reality. And what's that? Goblin Hood wanted to know. That you were always at fate's mercy, always lost, she replied groggily, finishing her ichor with a slurp and a shrug. And that none of this is really real in any permanent way. It should be pointed out that Goblin Hood kind of swallowed this little proclamation whole, assuming, of course, that Mandragora had once used telepathy to monitor someone's death. But actually, she was just talking out of her ass, the way everyone does about death. Even Goblin Hood's short, sharp shock crap was just someone's speculation, as far as G.H. knew. Neither Lazarus nor Jesus was available for questioning, and nobody else had ever even been supposed to have returned from full death, certainly not from beheading. The German serial killer, Peter Curtin, had a bizarre comment about the supposed limbo between decapitation and brain death, observed Goblin Hood after a while. He liked to see blood spurt during orgasms, and said that seeing his own blood spurting out of his severed neck would be the greatest thrill of all, or words to that effect. Was that what happened to him? Eventually, yes. then maybe he died happy. If he really did see the blood spurt and all that.
Yep.
Not that he deserved to. He sounds almost as atrocious as our late associate, Vlad Sepish. In a small way, yeah. They both committed atrocities. But what about the hanging of the Lincoln assassination conspirators? You made that sound like an atrocity photograph just now. Do you consider all capital punishment to be an atrocity?
I consider it to be a mistake, said Goblin Hood slowly, because it invites society to partake in killing, to participate in homicide, which allows society to become jaded about killing, just as murderers are said to become. And, as with Vlad a while back, it probably makes everything just that much less harmless. At least I think that's what's been going on around here lately. Partly, anyhow. But as for that hanging, well, one of the conspirators got sort of railroaded. According to that web of conspiracy book, all Mrs. Surratt had done was to operate a boarding house where the conspirators met. The court wouldn't convict her without the assurance that her sentence would be commuted to life imprisonment. Then the government reneged on the deal and hanged her anyway.
Ouch. Bet her last few moments were a drag.
You betcha. And to make it worse, the book suggested that she was deliberately killed to keep her from identifying a highly placed government official who was supposedly involved in the conspiracy, supposedly the same man in charge of the trial. That's what so obsessed my creator, that moment on the gallows when capital punishment maybe becomes outright murder, when the law is maybe even worse than the people it's putting to death. In any case, he had an almost religious attitude toward the photograph, which was probably also the first actual impression he ever really had of human death. But of course, the gob presently hastened to point out, as a kind of afterthought, all of my creator's toy hangings were perfectly harmless because none of the toy victims had been promised clemency. They both cackled.
What do you suppose caused Vlad's obsession with impalement? Asked Mandragora by and by.
Well, times were tough all over, mused the gob. Vlad's father got assassinated. One of his brothers got buried alive by enemies. At one point, one of Vlad's best friends betrayed him on pragmatic political grounds. All this probably helped to generate his negative attitude and the feeling that life was cheap. Then, too, he'd been captured and held hostage among the Turks during his youth. Again, I think, due to betrayal. He may have become fixated on impalement from watching the Turks do it. Besides, you know what they say about men in prisons. I've heard that said about the Turks in particular, too. It's been speculated that Vlad may have been sexually abused in captivity, and if so, maybe that warped his mind. But who knows, really? It's like wondering why Hitler was such a piece of shit.
Perhaps, commented Mandragora reflectively, anal sex itself is just a sublimation of the urge to impale people.
More likely the other way around, offered Goblin Hood thoughtfully, though I guess it'd depend on which came first. I suppose, said Mandragora after a while, that collecting atrocity pictures isn't too different from what Ikor does. Actually, she wasn't all that knowledgeable about the elusive Ikor, many of its members having apparently perfected some kind of psionic telepathy scrambling technology or something. In fact, Ikor was generally regarded as the most clandestine group anywhere throughout the entire Matrix. One rumor had it that not even full-fledged Ikor members were ever 100% certain about whether or not they were actually part of the group. This dovetailed nicely with another rumor that there actually was no Ikor, that people who thought they were in it were just a bunch of self-deluded fools, which, frankly, described almost everyone around these parts, in one way or another. Bella Madonna once talked to me about Ikor, mentioned Goblin Hood. She said that they'd opened up the Arachnid dimension or something. Well, yeah, or they were in on that or something. I've heard that too. But you know, Bella Madonna says a lot of things that go better with a little salt. In fact, I've always tentatively regarded that as a rumor spread by Ikor itself to make its members, if there really are any, sound like a bunch of big shots. I've never actually met anyone who's ever seen the Arachnid dimension, you know? Bella hasn't? Queried the gob, thinking about those strange candies of so long ago. Nah, or at least not that I can tell from reading her mind, though she's always hid her thoughts better than most of us. But I do know that she'll repeat almost anything about Ikor, the wackier the better, just to increase the bloated legend of it. She loves spreading the idea that Ikor might be out there, secretly right on top of everything, or at the bottom of everything. She spreads that paranoid little concept throughout the collective consciousness, like a minor computer virus or something, just to see how much trivial absurdity she can instigate. She does bring out the trivial absurdity in people, agreed the gob kind of absently. Well, when she met you, I believe you were pouncing on some hapless Korean for eating dogs or something. I was just stealing a scene, protested G.H., and besides, that was back in my wild and woolly days. And besides, my creator thought that would be funny, not me. I hardly had anything to do with it. I was barely even around. I was only following orders. Hell, I was only the postman, goddammit. Methinks the laddie doth protest too much, muttered Mandragora sarcastically. Gee whiz, whined the gob. Don't worry about it, laughed Mandragora kindly. I've read your mind often enough to know you're not really prejudiced against Koreans or against anybody. Gee willikers, ejaculated the gob, turning a little red around the eye holes and the mouth hole of his mask face. It often embarrassed him a little when one of the Black Widows talked so blatantly about his thoughts. He knew they could all read his mind, but he spent as much time as possible forgetting about that fact. It was either that or exercise a rigid form of mind control that he probably wasn't capable of anyway, and that he also thought might be insulting to his myriad paramours, an indication of mistrust. Anyway, they seemed to accept him, warts and all. Still, so many of his more lurid thoughts were about the Black Widows that he considered it rather stuffily bad form if they discussed his thoughts at all. He wanted to keep at least the illusion of privacy, a fact which they apparently found amusing. To him, one of them saying, "I've read your mind often enough," felt like some adult saying to a kid, "I changed your diapers when you were little." That may be true, ran his attitude on this subject, but who wants to have to know? At present, in any case, he didn't realize what kind of technical difficulties Mandragora was experiencing with her precognitive and telepathic psionic equipment. Mandragora could sense, or thought she could sense, from his evident discomfiture that he probably had sex on his mind right now. But she saw no point in twitting him regarding this, since she herself was still savoring the recent memory of that rim job in her own mind. Then, too, if she guessed wrong out loud about his thoughts, she'd blow whatever psychological advantage she had from him thinking that she could still read his mind. Not that she really needed any advantage over Goblinhood, who was a real pussy for women at heart, but the current incapacitation of her psychic faculties had left her feeling more than a little bit fragile. Meanwhile, she deliberately phrased her comments so as to turn his mind in that sort of direction, or at least in the direction of telepathy, and to get it off the subject of Koreans having had second thoughts. She regretted now that she'd ever brought the subject up. Mandragora had meant what she'd said about Goblinhood not being particularly prejudiced, because she knew that to be true. He was capable of various kinds of misanthropy, of course, and even of strong but usually well-reasoned biases. His dislike of Christianity, for instance, was well known. But he didn't dislike people for being Christians as long as they left him alone about it, a thing which some Christians, unfortunately, find hard to do, as do members of other proselytizing religions. But in terms of racial prejudice and bigotry, G.H. was probably no more susceptible to it than the average human being of any race, ethnic group, or culture, which admittedly isn't saying very much. Still, he tried hard not to be like that, having learned to dislike it through working with various leftist political groups in younger days, whose main prejudices were against right-wingers and, sadly, differently oriented leftists. As for the gob's misanthropy, while it was sometimes intense, it was also oddly egalitarian. If someone were to instruct him to pick out, for instance, what specific races on his native planet should be exterminated, the gob, with something akin to the wisdom of Solomon, would most likely say, "Get rid of all the bastards." Fair enough, right? During the notorious supermarket incident, in any case, G.H. had only associated Koreans with dog eating because he'd read that it was a custom there. For dramatic purposes, he'd tried to make it sound shocking, but without really meaning any aggressive criticism beyond the theatrics of the moment. It was, in fact, primarily the implied racism that allowed him to come off as an even bigger asshole than Barbarossa, which, for whatever stupid reason, had apparently been his purpose. He'd simply been acting as absurd as possible, Goblinhood unleashed, all in fun. no offense meant. But it was actually the fact that he didn't have any particular animosity toward Koreans in specific that interested Mandragora, because she knew something about him that he barely knew himself by virtue of having seldom thought about it for years. But she'd read it in his mind, briefly but tellingly, way back when he first recounted the supermarket tale about his first link-up with the Black Widows. Because this largely repressed memory also had to do with someone from Korea, and she couldn't help flashing on it whenever he asked himself a little guiltily whether he was, in fact, prejudiced. But the guilt, she knew, meant nothing, having been brought up according to the quaint doctrine of original sin. Guilt was almost the poor bastard's natural state. This was a strange story, and it was actually about the gob's creator. As a very young boy, Mandra figured that it might even predate the Cuban Missile Crisis, but she also knew that his time sense about those things was all fractured and shot to hell. That damage due, in part, to things like this, she decided crisply in her mind. Still, she was pretty sure that the artist's mother had still been alive during this horrid episode. She really hoped at this moment that she'd diverted Goblin Hood's thoughts away from this memory, away from O'Brien, if, indeed, she'd actually directed them there in the first place. Of course, the teacher's name hadn't actually been O'Brien, but rather some Korean name. O'Brien, however, was the name of someone in a book by George Orwell, someone who personified the totalitarian state. And it wasn't for being Korean that the gob's creator remembered this teacher. It was for being like O'Brien. Once upon a time, there was a Korean school teacher called, years later, O'Brien. Once upon a time, there was a little Midwestern grammar school in a rural village, a school where O'Brien taught civics. Once upon a time, there were three friends, Jimbo, Dimbo, and Zenbo, who all attended the civics class taught by one O'Brien out yonder in the rural community of Dogfuck, Ohio. These chums were like the three musketeers of civics. Jimbo was the gob's creator. Once upon a time, there was an era called the late 1950s and a place called the United States of America, which was when and where this true story really happened. It was interesting that O'Brien turned out to be the first person of widely different cultural or ethnic origin and background whom Jimbo had ever had any close contact with. Here's how that happened to come about. Dogfuck was pretty much of a segregated white society, although people like Jimbo's parents seldom mentioned racial issues in front of their son. But he discovered years later that the area had produced at least one grand mal, or whatever, of the Ku Klux Klan. Still, apart from the O'Brien incident, by the time Jimbo did come into contact with representatives of other races, religions, and creeds, he'd studied prejudice as a phenomenon on his own initiative and had very little blatant prejudice directly programmed into him. He rejected most of his actual programming out of hand anyway, thanks to the influence of the late 60s. But the O'Brien affair had entailed a special programming of its own, one he was never able to forget. Jimbo may have been in 5th, 6th, or 7th grade at the time. He was probably between 8 and 10 years of age. There was little to recommend this young whippersnapper at the time. He had no social skills. He had trouble keeping friends. He was probably about as malicious as most other kids around him, possibly less so than some, but not by much. Moreover, he may have been in some nebulous sort of pre-psychotic state, or he may have already been as crazy as a loon, in part made that way by religious indigestion there in that little white fundamentalist enclave. It was odd that a foreigner like O'Brien could teach at that little school, but perhaps it was also a sign of the times. O'Brien was obviously a South Korean, and the Korean War wasn't all that far in the past. Jimbo often wondered if war experiences had made O'Brien the way he was, or what. Jimbo could see where it might be that, or maybe it was just a culturally different approach to education. O'Brien had a reputation for strict discipline, and thus was presented as a species of scary bugbear to each new class, and as sort of a challenge, too, by members of preceding classes. But one had to get the full O'Brien treatment to really grasp this. Until then, most students dealt with the sense of authoritative intimidation by making fun of O'Brien, and particularly by making fun of his Korean accent. O'Brien called detention tensions. Ha ha, right? But it really wasn't all that funny. It belabors the obvious to point out that O'Brien, as the only Korean teacher around, as one of the very few foreigners around, must have had a pretty tough time with such disrespect, though he remained inscrutable. As far as anyone could see, he must have probably felt isolated, alienated, and secretly despised as an outsider of the first degree. Poor him, what? Then, too, he often pointed out in civics class, as an early forerunner of multiculturalism, perhaps, how much more respect students gave teachers and school systems back where he came from. But anybody could say that, or at least anybody who'd come from somewhere else. That might have been a crock. For all Jimbo knew, students were so goddamn disrespectful toward teachers and school systems back where O'Brien had come from that O'Brien's mind had snapped, and he'd come to this country determined to usher in a bold new age of student-teacher relations. Jimbo was pretty certain of one thing, though. O'Brien had taught him pretty early in the game that everything really was a crock, particularly everything pertaining to civics. Here was the problem. O'Brien was a lot like Kurtz in the Conrad story Heart of Darkness and in the Capella flick Apocalypse Now. It was felt by some that O'Brien's teaching methods were unsound. Only nobody ever went into the jungle to deal with O'Brien, at least not while Jimbo was around. Nobody ever called in any airstrikes. Parents complained about things like O'Brien pulling a student's hair or insulting his or her clothes and or personal hygiene during class. There must have been complaints about tensions as well. But the school system tacitly condoned O'Brien's singular behavior by letting it go on, like the CIA using American tax dollars to pay Guatemalan intelligence personnel who, on at least one occasion, were supposed to have tortured and murdered prisoners, including an American citizen. When this came out in the mid-1990s, the congressperson who made it public was threatened with censure by others in Congress for whistleblowing on the CIA, national security, and all that. It was all just a part of civics. It was all just a part of the crock. And so was Jimbo's boyhood school system. If there was a method in O'Brien's madness, it was apparently a method clandestinely approved of by the school, although nobody else used it. At least Jimbo didn't think so, but who knows, it may have been standard procedure. He never got detention from any other teacher there, and he sure as hell never got tensions from anyone but O'Brien. History does not record what Jimbo did in civics class to earn his first and only dose of tensions. Probably something stupid. Students treated tensions like a sort of merit badge among each other and tended to belittle the process until they'd been through it once, that is. Though some even belittled it after that. In any case, the ordeal had so completely overshadowed the offense that the ordeal was all Jimbo ever remembered. Tensions took place in an empty classroom where O'Brien sat grading papers and smiling inscrutably. Tensions lasted half an hour at a stretch, among the longest half hours in Jimbo's life, reminiscent of the Indonesian phrase Jam Keret, which means, according to SF writer Harlan Ellison, the hour that stretches. The easiest way to find out how the delinquent student felt during tensions is to try the following science experiment for yourself. 1. Go to the nearest blank wall. Pretend it's a blackboard. 2. Extend the index fingers only of each hand until they touch the wall with their tips. 3. Lean your full weight on these two digits, arms stretched forth, feet as far back as possible, standing on your tiptoes. 4. Because Mr. O'Brien will come over and kick your feet farther back if he feels that they're not back far enough. 5. Stay there, rigid, for 30 minutes. If you find, after an incomprehensible while, that you have to cry, try to do it silently, because O'Brien may come over and hassle you even worse if you make any noise. And besides, other students, good students, will be walking in and out of the room for various reasons, and will see you there, will see your humiliation and the shame of your tears. 6. Keep those goddamned feet back, I said. 7. Now, when it's over, go ye forth and sin no more. Many years later, it had entailed an Herculean effort for first Jimbo, then Goblin Hood, to type and revise St. Cloud's novel with one finger, the middle fuck you finger of their right hand. Typing with either index finger was like slow torture. Touching anything one with them, given the right mindset, could feel like splintering bones. Yet this may have been part of the standard educational procedure at the time, part of the regularly scheduled crock. It was treated as such. How are your index fingers feeling by now? Still at least 28 minutes to go, old bean. Watch those feet now. If you have to wet your pants, do that quietly too. Once upon a time, in those halcyon days of yore, those stirring days of yesteryear, those golden days of childhood and innocence, there were three pals, three chums, three fast friends, three bosom companions, three amigos, three desperados, three stooges, three blind mice, three little pigs against the big bad wolf, three horsemen haunted by a fourth, a triad of communion, a society, a tribunal of good fellowship, a triumvirate of brotherhood, the society of the three, the Holy Trinity, not the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, not animal, vegetable, and mineral, not Winkin, Blinkin, and Nod, but Jimbo, Dimbo, and Zenbo, the legendary three musketeers of civics, back in the glory days when there were giants in the earth back in those days, trapped back there like three bugs in amber by a fourth bug who should have known better, unless it was simply standard educational procedure at the time, way back yonder in those wild and woolly days of tensions. And the wildest and wooliest facet of this famous trio was the go-for-broke, hell-bent-for-leather lad known as Zenbo, who was the ringleader and perpetrator of something called the Notorious Report. Here's the scoop on that. It was Monday. Reports were due in. Zenbo alone, out of the entire class, had blown it off completely. Instead, he scribbled inanely all over an empty theme booklet right there in class while Jimbo and Dimbo snickered and egged him on, and while O'Brien watched blandly and inscrutably from his desk at the front of the room. The bell rang, signifying that class was over. Zenbo turned in the Notorious Report with a flourish, and everyone went to lunch, where the three musketeers of civics hilariously rehashed this adventure to their own considerable amusement. But all three were called to the principal's office, one by one, shortly before the lunch period was concluded. The joke was over. Jimbo may have been called last, but the order doesn't really count, because it was all a crock. When Jimbo got to the principal's office, nobody but O'Brien was there. The principal, a nice enough guy mostly, was nowhere around, because he was only the postman, and because it was all a crock. Jimbo was extremely agitated for fear that the Notorious Report and any complicity regarding it, concerning it, may have entailed a paddling verdict. He'd not been paddled since second grade, once, by a gentle elderly lady who seemed to weep as she lightly wielded a ping-pong paddle, delivering more humiliation than pain. But Jimbo had heard tell that office paddlings in the upper grades were no laughing matter at best, and in O'Brien's hands, God only knows. But evidently, paddling wasn't on the agenda today, but was instead only a crock. History doesn't record the exact conversation which ensued, because it too was such a crock. But the following approximates it. O'Brien, in broken English. Do you recognize this report, Jimbo?
Jimbo, with trepidation. I guess so.
O'Brien, did you write it?
Jimbo, no.
O'Brien, do you know who did?
Jimbo, approximately.
Of course I know, so do you, since you sat there and watched the whole thing. O'Brien, who wrote the notorious report, Jimbo?
Jimbo, don't you know?
O'Brien, I know, but you have to tell me or I give you tensions.
Jimbo, but why, you already know.
O'Brien, but you must tell me. The others have already told on you.
Jimbo, crying, his fingers aching.
Please don't make me rat on my friends.
O'Brien,
I want names.
Jimbo, please.
O'Brien, confess or we put out your eyes.
Jimbo, sobbing hysterically.
Please, Mr. O'Brien, this isn't necessary.
O'Brien,
you want your face eaten by rats, Jimbo?
Jimbo,
please, do it to Julia.
O'Brien, what was that?
Jimbo,
I said blubber gibber.
O'Brien, did Zenbo write it?
Jimbo, very quietly. Yes, there went that friendship.
O'Brien, did Dimbo watch and laugh?
Jimbo whispers,
yes. And that was all she wrote for the Three Musketeers of Civics.
O'Brien, pleasantly for him.
You've done well, Jimbo.
Jimbo, drying up, stolidly.
Uh-huh.
O'Brien, expansively.
No tensions for you, Jimbo.
Jimbo, weakly.
Thanks.
O'Brien,
go ye forth and sin no more.
Jimbo, more or less. You bet.
No problem. Case closed. Class dismissed. But alas, Jimbo had actually flunked an important test in civics that day, whether he really knew it or not. For many years to come, he would almost wish that the damage done could manifest itself somewhere, as concrete as his fingertips. An interesting sidelight. This little dust-up took place in the selfsame principal's office where Jimbo either would be or had already been informed of his mother's death by the nice guy principal, the good cop of the team, the postman. But not even Jimbo could ever sort out for sure which event happened first, or whether any effects of either were in any way epiphenomenal in relation to one another. And it really doesn't matter anyway, crock-wise. But talk about a crock. It's interesting to speculate about what the Shogun Squirrel would have made of the case of the notorious report. But it sure as hell doesn't take the best detective in town to crack a case like that, to solve a classroom mystery taking place in full view beneath one's nose. But it hadn't been the case itself that O'Brien had wanted to crack. He'd been too busy making an educational omelet for his big, bad civics class. The rotten bastard. Excuse me? Asked Mandragora at one point. I said, welcome back from the Ichor Zone, and I asked if you think the Shogun Squirrel is really a member of I-Corps, or does it just think it's a member? Geez, the squirrel's quite capable of thinking that it's King Kong. I know, laughed the gob. Mr. Big, I don't see how anybody could let the obnoxious little asshole into any group, sniffed Mandragora, much less into something as exclusive and esoteric as I-Corps is supposed to be. Though she still couldn't pick up the gob's thoughts, she could still register feeble sensory impacts emanating from the squirrel. This felt a little bit like escaping a smoke-filled room by sniffing the tiny layer of air under the smoke. The squirrel was awfully low down on the floor there. At this moment, the Shogun squirrel was quivering and jerking mildly in its sleep. Goblinhood thought that it was in the throes of some weird kind of delirium tremens. But Mandra was able to tell, much to her disgust, that the squirrel was only having a lurid pirate dream, a dream in which she herself was being made to walk the plank for offenses against the saltiest old sea dog of them all and the most famous and red-handed buccaneer on the high seas, Captain Shogun. She herself was gagged, but the piratical little rodent offered these last words of rapier-like wit as it goosed her between her bare buns with its dashing little rapier, which should technically have been a cutlass, and she went toppling helplessly overboard.
Bite my crank, matey.
In your dreams, you snot-nosed little turd, she sneered under her breath. Telepathy like this was worse than no telepathy at all. She was tempted to pour a glass of water on the uncouth squirrel and put a damper on its jolly little cerebral shenanigans. Hell, she was tempted to hoist high the Jolly Roger herself, to just squat over the little thug and piss right into its squirrely little fizz. But then the little jerk would have been awake and mouthier than ever, so she decided to forego these stern measures and to simply try keeping her mind out of that particular little gutter. Her anger at this, meanwhile, was a measure of how much the loss of her powers was bothering her. She'd never given a damn what the Shogun squirrel thought before, and she certainly hadn't cared what the little douchebag dreamed. Do you think someone can do psionic things without knowing it? Asked Goblinhood rather obscurely. How the hell would I know? Snapped Mandragora irritably. Goblinhood wondered what had gotten up her ass. I was only thinking about the legend of I-Corps, he said mildly, about how even the members might not be certain of their own status. But actually, he'd been thinking about something else, something left over from the aftermath of his swanky presidential campaign, a Shogun squirrel-type mystery called The Case of the Missing Mars Probe. Shortly before October of 1992, back on his original world, Goblinhood had noticed, while finishing paintings for a big exhibit called Myths of the Dream State, that a new Mars probe had just been launched by NASA. Since this threatened, within a year's time, to blast the whole Martian Sphinx theory wide open, G.H. had prudently decided to hedge his own bets on the subject. Thus, a small painting called Faxing the Boats to Mars had included this statement at the bottom. From his top secret campaign headquarters deep in the bowels of the prestigious Goblin Cave, Goblinhood faxes votes for him across space to the prestigious Martian Sphinx, where the votes can be multiplied and possibly transmogrified into a landslide. Science note, this may be your last good chance to believe in the Martian Sphinx before NASA's latest probe gets there and blows the folk myth by proving it was an optical illusion in the Viking photos, or before the Martian Provisional Government hides the evidence. Actually, this text-heavy picture only showed GH faxing five lousy votes to Mars, because that's how many folks there were in the Renegade Club, counting himself and, nominally, the head of Buckethead. Aside from tarot readings, GH had only been peripherally guilty of true outright prophecy once, in a cartoon about a dream written and published early in 1973, at least a year before Nixon's resignation. Goblinhood's creator had included, as a supposedly off-the-wall joke, the following dream newspaper headline, "Nixon Quits." In point of actual fact, Goblinhood hadn't even been around during this caper, wasn't even a gleam in his creator's eye at the time, wasn't even the postman. And he wasn't much of a prophet either, because a year after faxing the votes to Mars had been exhibited, the Mars probe, instead of reaching Mars and contacting Earth like it was supposed to, simply disappeared. That was certainly less trouble for the Martian Provisional Government than hiding the evidence or disappearing the Martian Sphinx or whatever. In keeping with his quasi-outlaw status, Goblinhood had occasionally claimed the credit for this billion-dollar snafu on behalf of the Martian Provisional Government, characterizing the disappearance as a warning or as an object lesson or sometimes even as an intelligence test, presumably to discover whether NASA would be foolish enough to waste any more expensive probes on a planet that so clearly valued its privacy. At other times, though, he'd said things like, "We didn't have anything to do with it. We weren't even around. Hey, look, if you people can't keep track of your own damn junk." But his review of these interplanetary events, so much further than light years away, was interrupted by a choked and subdued sob from across the squirrel. Startled, he looked up to see Mandragora weeping, face and hands. "Sweetheart, what is it?" he bleated in distress, scrambling around the supine rodent to hold her tightly in his arms. "I'm sorry," she wailed. "Ah, now," he murmured. "I didn't mean to snap at you," she blubberingly explained. "Oh, hey, I'm sorry I said what I did about the Korean," she blurted out, sobbing all the harder. "What Korean?" he asked soothingly. "I'm proud of you for not hating Koreans," she declared tearfully. "What are you talking about?" asked her mystified comforter, still trying to gentle her out of her sad state. "Oh, never mind," she decided, glad that he didn't know. And it was true. He didn't hate Koreans or any other race, despite the antics of O'Brien so long ago. It was authority that he'd learned to hate in civics class, particularly corrupt and malignant authority, which he'd learned to see almost everywhere. This was something of a failure for O'Brien, who had probably been trying, for whatever twisted reasons, to get the fledgling artist to hate himself. But dropping the subject didn't end Mandragora's flow of tears. She wept on and on, drenching her golden tarantula mask while Goblin Hood held her, stroking her hair, desperately whispering about how much he loved her. He was weeping too now, if only from a kind of shock. He couldn't remember whether he'd ever seen a black widow cry before. They seemed so strong, but when they let go, they just fell apart. Goblin Hood knew that crying, or catharsis anyway, was supposed to be healthy for people. He knew it from experience. There were parts in certain books by Kurt Vonnegut Jr., for instance, which almost always left him in tears, and he sometimes read those books for that purpose alone, being himself the kind of person who found it difficult to cry. But the tears of a loved one had always hurt him to the quick, not necessarily the brash yowling of tiny infants, however loved, who couldn't really communicate any other way, who cried all the time. Rather, the gentle crumbling of a beloved face as its owner broke down and lost control of it. Even thinking about such moments filled him with an empathic sense of tragedy. He wanted Mandragora to be strong and happy. He didn't want her ever to feel sad or miserable. It was a little bit like his sympathetic acrophobia. He suffered from fear of heights himself, but that was nothing compared to the sickening and vertiginous fear of seeing someone else about to fall off the edge, especially someone that he loved. Still, none of that prevented him from sort of enjoying this vulnerable moment of tenderness with the usually stalwart and phlegmatic black widow in the now soaked golden tarantula mask. One thing he didn't realize now was that Mandragora was suffering from a kind of nervous hysteria at the virtual disappearance of her psychic abilities, the disruption of her normal mindset. Very understandably, too, she was suddenly feeling lost, helpless, not in control, and above all, isolated and cut off from her usual defenses, perhaps in the face of great danger. For all the gob's short-term memory loss, his creator could remember back to nightmares that he'd had when he was about 5 or 6 years old. Many had been variations of one recurrent dream. He would hear noises downstairs. Leaving his bedroom, he'd pad down the stairs in his pajamas. It was always late at night, terminally late somehow. The dawn would never come. Yet he knew this outlook needn't last for a prolonged length of time. As in any dream, it only required seconds at the speed of thought for the dawn never to come. In fact, just the fleeting knowledge that it never would carried the full impact. Despite the hour, a big party was always going on in the huge, to his childish dreaming eyes, living room of the old farmhouse where he grew up. At first, charmed, the lad would mingle with the guests, mostly adults, but they seldom noticed or acknowledged him. Odd. Another odd thing. At times, there were great tensions among them, though they aped an almost frenzied calm. Other times, though, they seemed almost pathetically happy and oblivious to everything except joy. The odd thing was that both of these effects were, somehow, equally horrible in context. Perhaps in some versions of the dream, the child walked over to the undraped window and studied the reflection of the brightly lit room behind him, studied it until something strange took place, the climax of the dream. And the climax was always the same. one of the boy's greatest fears would walk into the room. Sometimes a gigantic bison buffalo would stroll in, once seen perhaps in a zoo, or a manifestation of ancestral guilt, perhaps, its massive head as big as a train. Sometimes it would even turn into a train, surging and roaring directly at him. His father worked for the railroad, so he'd seen lots of trains. Sometimes the bugbear would be a gorilla, but the really scary ones were the ones on TV that seemed more like live men, and usually were, in cheap costume epics. It would lurch toward him on its knuckles, eyes gleaming with evil intelligence. Or a spider, perhaps the size of a dog, coming at him, its hairy legs clicking horribly, its eyes manifesting evil intelligence times 8. Once, he'd found a cow's skull on the farm, and sometimes that would walk into the room, fiendishly horned and robed like the devil, and he was always its destination. Another, somehow, was the Joker from a deck of playing cards, its hellish grin pointed at him, its jests for him alone. But most of the time, the very scariest times, it was just a skeleton, an armature of polished bone, grinning at him, coming for him. And nobody else ever saw these things. That was the truly horrible part. The party went on, a skeleton in its midst, like Poe's Red Death, slowly advancing on a frightened young boy. Help! He tried to yell, but it came out as a sub-whisper, which nobody could hear, or which they all ignored. Sometimes even he couldn't hear it. Sometimes the people all froze in place. Eventually, they all usually disappeared. They never helped, so it didn't really matter if they were there or not, but it seemed so much more terrible without them. The lights so much brighter, the room so much bigger, and nothing at all between him and a horrifying human skeleton, except the possibility of waking up. He tried always to scream, with or without a voice. Sometimes it woke him up, screaming. In any case, he never remembered any further stage of the dream. But he thought of the dream often, years later, in that same living room, during the wake of his mother one night, thought silently. Mandragora felt like that now, tongue-tied, tongue-torn, unable to communicate, even to warn, not sure if anyone else was real, and desperately in need of some reality. But Goblinhood at least seemed real and responsive to her, and so she clutched him gratefully, calming down. She giggled, almost hysterically. For a moment, she'd wanted him to bless her, like a priest. And he was, after all, the nominal head of her church. But she'd never taken the religion that seriously. None of the widows had. How could they, having created it, or at least established it, themselves to begin with? She was reminded of a story called House of Ancestors by a writer named Gene Wolfe. This story perpetrated an historical anecdote about some emperor named Franz Joseph attending an opera version of Goethe's Faust. The small daughter of one of the emperor's courtiers saw a man backstage who was dressed as the Pope. She asked for his blessing. He had to explain to her that he was only a make-believe Pope. So she asked him to bless her doll. Mandra looked up and saw, over her lover's shoulder, the suitcase and Cosmic Weevil dolls gazing impassively at her from across the room. She giggled again. Nobody'd ever been able to read their minds except Goblinhood. At this point, the Shogun Squirrel sighed and turned over in its sleep. "Rosebud," it mumbled without waking up, drooling a little onto the floor. "Look," proposed Goblinhood, sotto voce, "this squirrel's racked out for the night. Would you feel better at the Star Trek festival?" "No," she whispered fiercely, hugging him as if the dawn would never come. "Please, I don't want to share you tonight." She hoped that the other widows were all lost in Trekkie limbo by now. Goblinhood, meanwhile, was so flattered and moved by this that it's a great pity she couldn't read his mind just now. The sheer warmth would have melted her heart in a hissing steam bath of ecstasy. An apt metaphor, that. She was surrounded by the cold of interstellar space, once linked to the galaxy, now severed from all other suns, lost in the hard vacuum, awaiting a problematical dawn. She needed his warmth tonight. And in some ways, where sex was concerned, for instance, the gob was as predictable and as reliable as Halley's Comet, except that he was probably warmer in some ways, and he came a lot more often than just once every 100 years or whatever it was. And the sex was good, no question. These black widows all had strong, nigh insatiable libidos, and Goblinhood, amazingly for such a wimp, could take potency, lust, and stamina to an almost asinine degree under the right circumstances. His tongue, for example, had been ribaldly nicknamed Old Faithful by the Merry Widows. But sex was only part of it, a mere emblem of how helplessly these two loved and adored each other. They would have probably felt the same without touching each other at all. Sex just so happened to be the thing she needed most tonight, because she could simulate telepathy during sex, and because she needed the normal, the commonplace, which is an indication of how much time he spent with his tongue or his dick up her ass, of just how routine that had become. In search of normality, she wanted to go back to that time before the squirrel frog had shown up, before she'd noticed how rapidly and extensively her talents were being occluded or destroyed. Back to him licking and sucking at her gaping rectal orifice, as though that could bring her powers back, too. Here's where simulated telepathy entered the equation. She'd put in a lot of sack time with the gob while bodyguarding him. She'd spent lots of that time fascinatedly reading his mind as he serviced her, seeing those stations of the cross from his perspective, feeling and savoring his own burning passions. She knew what it felt like, even tasted like, to kiss her own asshole, to ecstatically lick the inside of it, to want to crawl up into her own colon and live there, like one of the infamous snoids created by Robert Crumb in the classic 60s underground big-ass comics. She knew the purity, the beauty of this act, from reading it in the gob's own true thoughts. So if he went back to gobbling her poop suit as prologue to reaming the living shit out of it, she could know exactly, or at least approximately, what he was thinking and feeling. Close enough, anyway. Ironically, though, she might have been better off with her sisters, telepathically speaking. True, they were all lollygagging around in a state of Trek-induced stupefaction by this time, but their combined field at least served to keep them dimly in touch with each other, at least within the admittedly vast confines of the ballroom. But Mandragora had reached a familiar stage of ichor intoxication, perhaps unique to her alone, in which change of any kind seemed ominous, a state in which sameness seemed all-important. And she'd gotten used to being alone with the gob lately, even with the ubiquitous Shogun squirrel always hanging around, like a fly let in through a faulty screen door. Now Mandra wanted to core out her own quivering butt with Goblinhood's throbbing tongue, wanted to stick his rigid prick up her tight anal passage and melt both with friction, wanted to be there in his mind, at least in memory, worshipping her as his hot scum went mindlessly shooting into her trim, athletic, young bowels, as she thought of them. And she could sort of do that by running through all the usual crap with him and imagining in replay the last time she'd read his mind. At it. Instead of treasonal aphasia, she was becoming weirdly addicted to this, seeing herself being herself during those intimate moments, and sometimes even being herself, seeing herself, seeing herself, being herself during those intimate moments. And a lot more besides. She always felt like such a candy ass when the gob was licking her there. She felt she was made of spun sugar, lovingly decorated by the greatest artist of all time. She felt, for long moments at a stretch, that everything in nature was beautiful and worthy of love. Of course, anybody can feel some of that if they really try for it, just by getting their asshole convincingly smooched. But here's what Mandragora could also do when she was up to scratch. Actually, any Black Widow could. She could dive into the gob's head and see that she really was a delicious candy ass, an incredible confection of perfect flesh whose every molecule, both inside and out, fairly screamed to the gob, "Lick me." She could feel him wanting to thrust his tongue clear through her, threading the convoluted labyrinth past all the dark, semi-sweet, well, in fact, mostly bitter, chocolate packed so firmly all around, finally wrapping his tongue around her own from behind in a kind of glorious, absolute abandon. She could feel herself wanting that, too. She could see him put their dick up to the gaping, mysterious portal, its mystery perpetually self-renewing. so tight and virginal, so fat and sassy, and this not even cognitive dissonance, so-called, but rather two distinct viewpoints beginning to melt and flow together. She could feel the stinging pain as they carefully entered her, and feel it being transformed into the ripe, gamey pleasure as certain nerve endings sent certain impulses to a certain mysterious area in her brain. And she could also feel in his head the intense thrill of that so taboo penetration, conquest of the backyard, adventures along the dirt road, the brown speedway, the last stop, usually for unwanted things, ignominiously leaving her body, being expelled, in fact. But now we have distinguished visitors entering there and politely wiping their feet, or at least a visitor, a strapping fellow, wiping himself ever more vigorously on the already mud-stained doormat. "Howdy, stranger. Come on in and set a spell. Make yourself to home. But don't actually stop, okay? See if you can break the sound barrier. Is that a gun in your pocket, or are yas just glad to see be me? Meanwhile, faster, faster. Swab my barrel, matey. Don't fire till you see the light." Which is a kind of fun, of course. And of course, the increasing friction excited and inflamed them both with its pungent semi-threat of evisceration. She sails clear over the top, trailing glistening bowels behind her like clouds of glory. But more interestingly, she would savor the way such thoughts, combined with heat and friction, started to focus the gob's full attention on the head of his dick, with her attention riding shotgun, and on the magic earthen membrane surrounding it, closing her mind's eye like a brown eye clamping shut around a foreign body, a distended moat. She'd touch base back in her own head and, fingering her tits, her genitals, try to sense the conditions of her own lower intestinal region, of her own rosy red rectum. What gives? All clear? Will this be a clean fuck? Or will we have to say, sheepishly or otherwise, shit happens? Then she'd zip back out and check, like a kind of game, if the shaft was still clean, moving almost too fast to see though, then she won. She probably had the cleanest asshole in town. Hurrah! If not, then she didn't exactly lose. Instead, she turned her face half toward G.H. and permitted herself a faint blush, somehow empathically burning right through that golden tarantula mask of hers, dig, and hoped he'd survive the sudden pounding of his own blood as she thrilled to the sheer perverse magic of the intoxicating effect that her embarrassment had upon him. And she could feel it too. Wow, too much. Put up a perimeter of police tape, men working signs, not a damn molecule covering and not a damn manhole covering in sight. So watch your step. Wear those eavesdroppings and strike up the band. Somebody's privacy is like being totally violated over here. It's almost as good as an autopsy. Let's see what she had for breakfast. But she already knew. And she knew, too, that these last were her own thoughts alone, grimacing into a kind of emotional mirror for her own amusement. Because Goblinhood wasn't thinking by now, only feeling, and projecting one message non-stop. I love. Goddess. So beautiful. Everything. As their jellied loins rapidly disappeared in a kind of frothy blur. She'd surge on up there to his mind in a jiffy, fast as the speed of thought, to see how close he was to it. Pretty damn close. And how this bestial, crude form, ramrodding furiously into that rampant little shit pit, did now start to actually growl like a mindless animal, transfixed with pleasure so great it was almost pain, and the inarticulate thoughts now, org, rigu, ach, behind the demi-mask of agonized rapture, too good to be true, every time, almost there, and she locked in on his brainwaves. She had a stake in this impalement. As she felt him going over his edge, she screamed in his mind, I wish the dick was 10 feet long and 3 feet thick, so we could split me clean open like a juicy little grapefruit. Detonation. The blinding flash. A vast bubble of light as the air heats up to a zillion degrees and can no longer be seen through. And then, what do you know? The real detonation. The sky is blind. This bubble spans miles, can melt dreams, shockwaves speeding clear to infinity. Never mind tomorrow. You can't get there from here. High yield, multi-megaton range, Ratza Ruck. Finally, breakaway point, and you can see through the air again. Well, that's convenient, isn't it? Not much to see, though. Just the same old mushroom, iced with fire, thermonuclear gills, dripping brimstone. Ice caps, so cold they're hot. Hot stuff. Eternal fungi. Fertility symbol. Surrounded by rings, ever widening, creeping across horizon. Huri zone. Condensation. Condensed milk of paradise. Count the rings. Just one big one, in a way, a big tube of shocked atmosphere surrounding this pulsating mushroom, bells ringing, skirts sliding down, hoops whooping, cum dribbling down, stalk festooned with squeezing asshole as, beneath his swaying eminence, she comes to her own rescue when she comes. More celestial fireworks, unimaginable to mind of mere man. Goblinhood almost out to lunch, almost crying at intensity of his own fading orgasm. She can't resist, awfully busy her. Peeks at his mind, still incoherent, but sounds like he loves her. Oh, well, wants to kiss her golden ass forever. What else is new? Nothing under the sun, nor beneath the various moons. Approximately Ecclesiastes. And afterward? Well, things slow down, cool off, catch breath, come to grips. Goblin Hood panting, gasping, almost sobbing, her own body still coming in little aftershocks from whatever she did to it there at the end, her own little secret, an old family recipe, probably involving a special sauce. After a while, she strolls languidly back on over to his mind, but not much is happening over there, his mind exhausted, smoking a cigarette, but loving her forever, wanting to kiss her sweet ass always, and other songs from the same album. He gently touches her back, strokes,